Monday, January 28th. It's LA Podcast.
That was dramatic.
What a week. Welcome back, Alyssa.
Thank you. I won my race, by the way.
I won my...
It's like, it's also, it's a race, but then also how many like donuts you can do like in
style points
in the middle of the intersection. Yeah.
Were you doing racing for pinks or? I don't know if that's still how they do it.
a lot of action, a lot of stuff to get into this week. Let's tell some LA stories first. Alyssa, you and I have kind of the same one. We both did the homeless count.
Yeah.
Where were you assigned?
I was in my neighborhood in Westlake.
Okay. What was your specific like tract though?
Oh, the number?
Mine was not that big and it was just like a pretty small. It was like a couple intersections.
Yeah, mine was really close to my house, which was kind of cool. So it was streets I knew really, really well. And I had walked around a lot of times and very residential. So
yeah.
Very quiet. Yeah.
I had Hoover under the 101, which is like a serious encampment. But it was frustrating in a way because last year I've mentioned that my numbers were very low and I sort of felt like I was like depriving the people who are homeless of services by not counting enough. But this year I was like, okay, the numbers are, get ready for some big numbers here. But it was only one side of the street on Hoover was an R zone. And it was a side that I think had just been fully cleaned out, been swept. And then under the overpass, there's like a little fenced in area. And on John Street, there's a ton of people, but we cut off just before that. It's almost, almost like matched the line of the area that we were counting. Everyone was just outside of it. So this year again, my count was not super high. I have lost some sleep over it. It's just like what this whole thing drives home to me. And turnout was great. I don't know how it was in your
really good
neighborhood.
Yeah.
Same as last year.
So you came from the north. We were very close to each other then. We were I was just on the other side of the 101.
I was in the south side of the Silver Lake County.
Right.
But I mean, I just can't help but think about how arbitrary the final number is based on how they do this count.
Right. So I guess I was talking to some people who had done counts in West Hollywood and maybe somewhere in the Valley, maybe Burbank, and they do it completely different. They count differently. And I do think you're right. It's interesting that you mark people you see, but also vehicles you see and also encampments that you see, like sleeping areas, but they have some name for it, but I can't remember.
Right. Makeshift structures.
Makeshift shelter. And then there must be, like an algorithm or something like that crunches everything that you find and says, well, probably these many people are sleeping.
Yeah.
It guesses.
And the vehicles, they basically tell you to guess if the windows are covered or.
Right. Like there's vehicles you aren't definitely sure if someone's living in them.
I was walking around thinking, my car has at times been in a condition that probably would have been counted under these terms, but it's all guessing.
Yeah.
And so that's why, I mean, I'm very curious to see what the number is this year. But when last year they said, we have a 3% reduction. That is
I don't know
so
how they could
far
do that.
Within the like standard deviation of error,
right.
Counting like the way that we do. And I know USC goes out; they have like special teams that help confirm the counts, like,
right? And I was based out of Path, which is there were dozens of people there who work full time, and we asked a ton of questions. And they obviously they know very by a first name basis, like most of the people that come there for services and along the 101 there's just like probably hundreds of people living just in those few blocks, right there, which they didn't count because I think they've counted them.
Sure.
But the other, going back to your other question too, about, if it had just rained, it had been like a week of like crazy rain.
Yeah.
And I wondered too, if that the cold weather or the rain makes more people go inside, and that's why they maybe do it in January so they can get an accurate count of who's in the shelters and then who really would be toughing it out outside. And then also, like, are they doing sweeps? Like you said, is LAPD coming through and trying to clear some of these people out so the numbers look different, or would you leave them? I was had so many of the same questions as we were walking around. Yeah. I was like,
For example, I know they're doing they did sweeps prior to the rains along the river, which they, of course they were right to do because that's how people die when it rains. But they don't put those people in shelter when they sweep them out. They have the option sometimes of going in some kind of winter shelter. But for the most part, they're just kind of in the wind. Mm. And so that seems like it would make them harder to count because in all cases, you're kind of relying on like a sense of where people are for most of the numbers. And I don't like the people on the river. I'm not even sure where a lot of them went. And there were sweeps in Koreatown too, right?
Yeah. K-Town for All posted on Twitter that there had been sweeps, I think the very same day that like immediately before people went out to do the count.
So. Oh, wow. Yeah. Like on Thursday then. Wow. Yeah. I mean, that was my biggest question, I think, was looking around and being like, is this accurate? And I know that, you know, there are professionals and I know that they know what they're doing and, you know, they want to target the services to where the most people are. That makes a lot of sense. But I also, how could you even do it? I mean, how can you take on this monumental task, which is getting harder and harder to do?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Scott, what'd you do this week?
I had a very uneventful week. I did not do the homeless count. Unfortunately, I intended to sign up and kept pushing it back and then forgot.
We were full, so I would have. I would have personally turned you away.
That's fine. But yeah, no. I mean, in lieu of my story, I'm gonna defer just so we could get into our stuff for this week.
Let's talk about the strike. It's over.
The strike ended.
The 6-day war.
We predicted it was going to be over on Tuesday. It was not quite accurate.
You specifically, you predicted Tuesday. Yeah. But it did, but they did come to an agreement on Tuesday.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I think we said they were going to be back in school on Tuesday.
Yes, we said that agreement Monday, back in school Tuesday. Right. You missed it by one day.
A little bit. But yeah, so there was a marathon, 21-hour bargaining session from Monday to 6:30 Tuesday morning. And that was the final day of bargaining. Both sides came to an agreement, which was then announced by school district reps Eric Garcetti and Alex Caputo-Pearl of UTLA at 9 on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you said, 6-day war. Mm-hmm. It resulted in, I think, the union, particularly the union, feeling like they had accomplished a lot of their goals as far as the union leadership is concerned. There was, I think, among the rank and file, a little bit more of, mixed feelings about the final outcome. But I think overall, a lot of people were feeling pretty enthusiastic about the deal that they were able to get from the union.
Let's talk a little bit about what the teachers got. So the big sticking point in these negotiations was about class size. Yeah. We had the teachers who came on this show talk about how they're teaching middle school science courses with 40 people in them. Yep. And that was a big thing that they were fighting for. The deal calls for a class size reduction of about 4 students across 3 years. There are some schools, about 90 schools, that are going to see a bigger drop, about 6 students per class in that time. But that's the class size reduction. And then there are going to be more talks about 3 years down the line, I think, setting limits in terms of the number of students per class.
So currently we actually, as you were saying, when we were talking to, when we talked to teachers on our program, they had mentioned that you have, in some cases, math classes with up to 50 students in a classroom. Yeah. The official stated cap right now, according to the union, is somewhere around the range of like 46 students. Uh-huh. So, part of this deal limits at 39, the number of students that can be in high school English and math classes. That is certainly not as much of a reduction as teachers in the Unified School District would like to see.
It's too high.
It's still too high, but I think it is a much stronger commitment than they've been able to secure previously from the school district. So it is, in that regard, a win. I think they're coming out of this process, there has been an understanding on both sides that from here, there's going to need to be state funding in order to get that, in order to get the caps down to what would be considered a more reasonable level.
Seems like some of the bigger wins, honestly, for UTLA came in hiring of not teachers, but other staff. The district is going to hire 300 nurses. There's going to be a full-time nurse in every school. Because one of the complaints is there are schools that have nurses like 2 days a week.
Yeah.
And if a kid gets hurt, they just go to the hospital or get sent home or a teacher has to take care of them.
Right.
82 teacher librarians are going to be hired so that every secondary school campus is going to have a full-time librarian. They're going to add a bunch of full-time counselors as well over the next 3 years. So that is like a legitimate win.
That's a win.
For UTLA. There are also going to be some conversations about capping charter schools, nothing official, but UTLA gets to be at the table in conversations about limits on charter schools going forward. And also the salary increases, they got a 6% increase. 3% of it is retroactive to last year. Actually, 3% is retroactive to 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It's all retroactive.
Yeah. And so this 6% number is, if you've been following our conversations about the strike or the bargaining on this program, that is a number that has been set in stone for a while now. And we were saying back in December and November that the pay raise was not really the sticking point.
That was pretty well settled for a long time.
Yeah. So that they wanted the 6.5% raise, but the teachers have been saying very loud and clear throughout this entire process what they really wanted were those support staff and the lower class sizes. It was really about getting resources for students that they felt like were necessary to ensure a safe and effective learning environment.
So it's a good deal for the teachers. They accomplished some of their stated goals. I guess my question is, Alyssa, why did it take a strike? It seems like I'm not sure why they couldn't have come to this deal in the months and months and months leading up to a strike. Why did it take 6 days of giant funding losses for the district?
A week of no pay for teachers.
Yes, kids being out of school for a week, like pretty damaging stuff for a lot of people. Like, why could this not get worked out before that?
I mean, doesn't it really kind of point to the leadership not being able to seal the deal?
Well, great question, because the leadership has spoken out about this. Mayor Garcetti's victory tour continues about a week after the strike has ended.
International.
Yes. Yes. he has been very outspoken about how it took his mediation in order to settle this deal. There's a lot of evidence that this is true. It does seem like there was very little trust between LAUSD and UTLA. It took some other body. They had mediators that definitely weren't getting the job done. The mayor showed up. He established a policy of no leaks. They basically seemed like they locked both parties in the room at City Hall for a few days until they got the deal worked out. And Kyle Stokes at KBCC reported that UTLA was about to walk out on the deal at the last second. If like a couple more concessions weren't made, the LAUSD weren't budging on. Garcetti begged him not to walk out. Alex Caputo-Pearl from UTLA said that they were going to. Then he went back to LAUSD and got the stuff that the teachers wanted. So, I think his involvement when it came was effective, but
why didn't he step in earlier? Yeah. How did it get to this point? And it wasn't just, you know, the last couple of months or years. This has been building for a long time. I mean, it's
so
been,
long.
Yeah. So I think looking at from the parents' perspective, just a lot of the parents that I've spoken with after this happened, you know, it was everybody took their kids down to the rally the last day. Like, it was supposed to be another rally, and then it was just like a party basically in the streets to like celebrate, which is really cool. But just seeing the parents, you know, who were kind of new to the school. I know a lot of younger people have younger kids, and the big question among parents right now is, does this mean things are going to get a lot better, or does this mean we have to like fight and kick ass for like, you know, continue to do this like every year to make sure that they stick to
this
stuff.
Does this become like Oaxaca or whatever, where the teachers, it's just like an annual holiday where the teachers go on strike.
And I guess like having a new superintendent and this school board that's in you know, in another transformation on its hands, you know, potentially. It's still kind of worrisome, and we don't really know. We still don't really know if this is all going to happen, and we're not really sure what how a lot of this stuff is going to be delivered. Like another thing that is in the agreement is like greener campuses and a focus more on community schools. And I don't even, I walked by like two of the schools in my neighborhood this weekend, and I was like, where do you even begin? Like these are asphalt, like, you know, acres and acres of asphalt.
I think, Hayes, to your question, like, well, why did it take, why did the strike become a necessary step in order for to achieve what they eventually did achieve? When you look at the deal that was made and knowing that this has been a process that has lasted for, what, 2 years now that they've been working without an established contract. The sticking points being what they were, being the district being unwilling to commit to hiring more support staff, being unwilling to commit to lowering class sizes, which they said that they could not do. It's interesting to me that and this is where I think that the union can really point to this strike action and say it was an unequivocal success, because they've been saying for years at this point that the district has been unwilling to lower class sizes, even though it is well known that that is an extremely important factor in student learning outcomes. The district has been basically stashing money for a rainy day or whatever, while the district continues to just essentially bleed out financially, and students are not actually being successful in the classroom. The union has been saying that fairly consistently, and the result seems to back them up in so far as the strike was necessary and did actually achieve a lowering of the of the student class sizes. So given that, I think it's interesting that when we talk about this final almost day-long bargaining table that Garcetti was sitting in mediation over, the final thing where Alex Caputo Pearl was going to walk away, where the union was going to walk away, was that they were saying that there was a clause in the contract. They had actually come out and said this publicly one of the previous times that they walked away from the table immediately prior to the strike, that the union, or that the school district, was using basically cagey language that would allow them to temporarily lower class sizes and then raise them again. So the final day, when they were saying that they were going to walk away from the table, they were saying that language is still in there. Buettner refused to change it. It said, like, which kind of lends credence to the concerns of
it. That they were going to use it for something.
Trust me.
That does kind of lend credence to that. That was the final unresolved issue, was that the school district wanted to give itself some sort of out within the contract language that would allow them more flexibility in increasing school class sizes in the future. So that was the point at which Garcetti said, and this is kind of interesting, he apparently, although he is on a national tour, tooting his own horn at this point, he basically went and said to Buettner that if both sides, or if there's not an agreement right now, if the union walks away from the table, that he's going to go public and basically wash his hands of it and say it's their fault that this deal didn't work out.
Yeah.
And that was apparently what convinced Buettner to, because he, I think anybody observing could see that the school district was not winning the perception battle.
So that, I think, is a huge aspect of this and why it came to a strike and why LAUSD had to make the concessions that it did after the strike. It feels like the shutdown, basically, where both sides are waging a war of public opinion. I'm guessing the LAUSD thought that they could portray the teachers as too demanding in a way that teachers' unions have been portrayed for the last decade, effectively. And they lost the war of public opinion worse than I could have possibly imagined they would. support for the teachers from national celebrities and locally was bigger than I think anyone thought. And I think they must have looked at that and just had like a gut check of like, we are being made out to be, like, it cost them a huge amount in terms of PR. They were the villains of this. And I think it's because we were talking before the record. It's just so easy to say when people are like, well, what are they fighting? They get unbelievable benefits, mm-hmm. like their salary. They don't have to work in the summer. The stuff that like people always say. Yeah. Is class sizes of 40 plus.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all like you, it really comes down to that is disgraceful.
And I haven't met I haven't talked to a single person about this who when you say, yeah, that teachers are dealing with class sizes of 40 and 50. You don't say that to anybody without the reaction just being, people are just completely appalled by that.
Yeah.
And nobody thinks
they're like, that's too big for like a dog daycare.
Yes. Like, like you could not teach dogs in that environment. No. Absolutely not. And nobody would expect you to. So yeah, I think you're 100% right. I was also, I thought that it was exhilarating, but also very surprising the extent to which the public sided with the teachers. And yeah, I do think, and this is where I kind of, I think we have an interesting question of the way that this reflects on Buettner as superintendent, this whole process, and also the way that this reflects on Garcetti, which we can talk more about in a second. But
yeah,
in terms of Buettner's leadership, the fact that this is interesting to me, this is really probably his first major test. It's not his first test since being appointed superintendent, but probably the largest issue that he's had to deal with, certainly the most nationally prominent. And you do kind of wonder, like, where everything is at risk of falling apart early Tuesday morning, and he basically has to be threatened by Garcetti that, yep, Garcetti is going to stop being the publicity shield for him in the event that it doesn't work out here. That to me is kind of like, why did it come to that point? Why was it so important for the school district to have the ability to do what is extremely unfathomably unpopular and boost school classroom sizes back up? Why is it so important that they be able to do that?
Makes me think that's what he was brought in to do. Right. I think that was pretty explicitly his job when he was hired by the wing of the school board that is less aligned with the teachers union, to basically take the hardest line possible. Comes from a business background, has experience in like jobs before of being like a tough negotiator.
Yep.
And I think that was an absolute, like, giving in on these things was the absolute last resort. And yep, that's what it ended up being.
And it's just so interesting because I have a lot of really strong feelings about businessmen as some kind of platonic ideal for government service provision. But it is interesting that it is happening. This is happening sort of in parallel with the government's shutdown that also, yeah, ended this week. By the way, Garcetti, Hunter Owens was right about that. or the respondents to that Twitter poll were right.
Oh, yeah. There was a poll asking whether which would end first. And most people said the
strike.
The strike.
They were right by a couple of days.
And they were right.
I do just think like the business negotiating tactic of just stonewalling and, yeah, just giving nothing until the absolute last second or beyond, that doesn't seem like it works, or it doesn't.
We might just be living in a time period, yeah, where people are feel more positively about labor. I mean, we had basically an air traffic controller strike almost last week. Compare, right, that to the one of the 80s,
yeah,
where people were not sympathetic to it, but they are now.
Right.
So, I mean, it might just be like public opinion is in a little different place than it was. So interesting that you would mention a comparison between the shutdown and the strike, because Mayor Garcetti actually found some similar comparisons. He wrote what you, Scott, described as a live journal in in the LA Daily News. Let me pull it up.
Well, let's mention too that at the end of last week was the U.S. Mayor's Leadership Conference that they have in D.C. every year.
Hashtag mayors get things done.
So it's this big, they all get together, and it was kind of funny to be set against the shutdown of the federal government because, of course, what they're all going to do is, and a bunch of them are running for president, including possibly our mayor, but they all got up there and talked about how much more effective mayors are. And there was a story in The Atlantic about how Garcetti, you know, said, like, if I had gotten in there,
right,
if these mayors getting in there, we would, this shutdown would be over.
Yeah,
there was a ton of links between Garcetti and the shutdown in the media. There was a really funny thing that someone sent to us that Garcetti had a press availability where he was going to announce that the city was going to offer aid to furloughed federal workers, which is great. It unfortunately coincided with the announcement.
The shutdown ended.
Yeah, that's right. This has been canceled.
Rahm Emanuel came out and said that Garcetti ended the strike in 6 days. Compare that to what happened at the federal level.
Yeah.
And then Garcetti, I have never seen him openly and so relentlessly self-promoting.
Yeah. He turned a mistake into part of the pattern.
Read the live journal though.
I just want to point out, we were saying going into the strike and the corruption scandal that's ripping its way through City Hall, that this was maybe the end of Garcetti's presidential campaign. These two things happening at once. It's around getting close, hopefully, to the time that he has to make a decision about this stuff.
Right.
And we thought that there was no way that he was going to be able to do it. And then this kind of shows where he's at, this live journal in the LA Daily News. It was pouring outside. As I listened to the voices of tens of thousands of Angelenos, most of them teachers, outside my window, I was on the phone, encouraging both sides of the dispute to come back to the table, this time in City Hall. Between the voices outside and the frustration I heard on the phone, I couldn't help but think about Washington, D.C., now in its longest government shutdown, and the inability of our national leaders to find common ground, resulting in families suffering across our country. So this is an amazing coincidence. This rhetoric is exactly what he's been kind of stumping on all the way through his pseudo campaign about how we need people that can bring, there's too much division in our politics now. We need somebody who can bring, there's no red America and blue America. There's only America. And we just, the blanket, the quilt is torn and I have my sewing kit. Like that is how he's been talking all the way down. I kind of realize what has sort of always bothered me about that, when he applies it to the strike, because he pins all this on Washington, D.C., that Washington, D.C. is dividing us as Americans.
Yep.
But it also implies that we're sort of just divided over nothing, that all we have to do is like put our differences aside and like learn to listen to each other. Whereas like you compare that with someone like Elizabeth Warren, who is coming out and saying there's systemic rot that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that's what I'm really... Like, how can you run on that? How can you run on not that these things need to be fixed?
Even ASAP. Hillary Clinton took a stronger stand than that in 2016.
Yeah.
She
yeah.
would not have said that the differences were fabricated.
Yeah.
That which is basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
It's an illusory divide.
That we just need to sort of change our mindset and do like hands across America. And like,
so he wants to be like chief mediator.
Yeah. But that didn't apply to the strike either. I mean, there were legitimate grievances that really needed to be hammered out. It was a difficult solution. And as he points that out in the article, he says that LAUSD is like basically insolvent, but the situation for the teachers is like totally untenable. So there are practical policy matters that need to be figured out. It's not just an issue of like, well, I guess we do have a lot in common after all. We all are, we are all Americans. That's just like, it drives me crazy. He's sort of saying that it's our fault for like falling for.
Yeah, not getting along well enough or something.
The idea that we're divided instead of things that actually need to be changed. But
maybe
we're
all just too anxiety.
So this is a word that re-entered Garcetti's vocabulary this week. So weeks and months ago, Scott and I listened to an episode of Ezra Klein's podcast where he interviewed Garcetti. It was like a 3-hour record.
Yeah.
This is like the Lost LA podcast sessions.
Sarah was stranded down the street at a bar waiting
for me. That's right.
Me.
I remember that. And then I tried to edit it together and it was so like it would have taken like a week of work basically to do it. And so I just finally gave up on it. But in that interview, he first introduced the concept of anxiety. And when he looks out across America, this is what he sees we're experiencing right now. How does he define anxiety?
Feeling anxious and excited at the same time. There are a lot of changes.
There's so many opportunities ahead of us, but we're a little bit like nervous about them.
Right.
Like the word innovation is in there too somewhere.
Yeah,
of course.
And he somehow, and when he was in DC, he brought this word out again. And then the article that was written about it, he said like against the advice of his advisors, he started talking about anxiety again. It is, I guess it's something he's like, he seems very proud of like having come up with this and he really wants to make it happen.
It's so interesting because it does seem like in the press when they're talking about this, they immediately describe him as wonkish because I guess it doesn't really make sense that you're a politician of relatively low profile on a national stage and you want your introduction to the electorate at large to be you using this really not catchy
unspellable word. I mean, watch it become like his campaign slogan, like get anxiety for Garcetti.
I've seen people spelling it with the X and the C.
Oh, yeah, you can't do that.
If you made like a word cloud for Garcetti, the two of the biggest words would be anxiety and bisabuela. His speeches, he always talks about his bisabuela. Okay, let's talk. Should we get into more electoral politics in LA? There was some stuff even from last week that Scott and I forgot to talk about that was pretty big news. Let's talk about Mark Ridley Thomas, currently the county supervisor for the second district of the county. He has been a little bit cagey about whether or not he is running for city council in District 10, basically trading seats with Council President Herb Wesson. But then it turned out he sent out an email to his mailing list saying, like, please support my campaign for CD10.
You know, come to my, like, Super Bowl party and we will.
Yeah, right? And we'll talk about my upcoming campaign.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, sort of a weird way to announce. But it does make sense that right now, at this moment, he would be a little shady about his future political ambitions because his son, who we talked about in our first episode of LA podcast almost a year ago now, his son Sebastian Ridley Thomas was a state assemblyman, and he very suddenly, coincidentally, in the midst of a lot of the Me Too stuff going on, resigned from the state assembly for health concerns. He said he had 6 surgeries over the course of the previous few months, couldn't do the job anymore, was stepping down in like 3 days. Wasn't it like an instant resignation, basically? Yeah. And then it turned out later he was given a job both as a professor and a student simultaneously at USC, coincidentally, in a school at USC that had taken a lot of donations from his father, Mark Ridley Thomas. It came out last week. There was an investigation done by the assembly over certain allegations against Sebastian Ridley Thomas. It came out that he had been accused of sexual harassment, which everyone knew. I mean, it was the most obvious thing that this was a cover up and that the story of health concerns was not the real reason that he was stepping down.
Now, his camp, for their part, said that it was like the most egregious case ever, that he had been basically railroaded.
Yeah.
And I think they were still saying that that was not why he resigned.
Egregious comes to mind.
It really does. This.
It's really brazen to say that you just so happen to be stepping down because of health concerns at the same time as you are getting these sexual harassment allegations, when people within the state legislature are also stepping down for allegations against them. How does this connect to Mark Ridley Thomas? He did help cover this up and basically lied on behalf of his son.
And has been helping him get a number of jobs since then, as it would appear.
Yes.
At first at USC, and then
now it turns out that he just showed up in an article last week that he's consulting for LAUSD.
Yeah, and it's so funny. Like, when you have somebody, if you're hiring somebody to do lobbying work for you, or to be a professor, for example, something like that, where in the back of your mind, you're thinking, like, if anybody ever finds out that we hired this guy, we're going to have to fire him.
Right.
Maybe you shouldn't hire him in the first place. The LAUSD actually said once it became public knowledge that the assembly had found these allegations credible, that he was terminated immediately. Huh. He was on a 4-week contract as a lobbying entity. His lobbyist firm, Millennial Advisors.
That rules. That is so funny.
Famously, wow. Sebastian Ridley Thomas is the only millennial in California. He always brands himself thus. So, it just seems like this is actually amazing from the Sacramento Bee editorial board. Bye. This should be every legislator's response if former Assemblyman Sebastian Ridley Thomas comes knocking on their door in his new role as a lobbyist.
By BYE.
BYE. Nobody should work with
that. Not BUY. Yeah, but I mean, I sort of can't help but wonder if I knew that he had done something wrong in the assembly, why did no one else thought it was weird that he resigned so suddenly and like the height of the Me Too movement? Like, they were still willing to hire him just on the pretense that he had health concerns. And also, why weren't they concerned about his health? That it was only like a few months later.
Right.
But the whole thing does kind of cast a shadow over the Mark Ridley Thomas campaign. But I think it just sort of underscores, I mean, the reason all these institutions would continue to hire his son after obviously the allegations had already come out. Is his power, especially in the district that includes USC. Definitely sufficient power to have him coast into CD10 if that's what he wants to do. I mean, yep. I'm not even sure who would be willing to run against someone that has as much like name recognition as he does in that district. At the same time, we have a new but familiar face in the campaign to replace him in the county, Supervisor District 2. Running against Herb Wesson is Jan Perry. Jan Perry used to be the council member in District 9 in that same part of the city. She ran a not super memorable mayoral campaign against Garcetti. And got wiped out pretty quickly.
Yep.
I guess she was sort of the third.
Ended up supporting Garcetti, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right, because they were on the council together at the same time.
So Jan Perry, the district now represented by Curran Price, of course, who is under investigation with the FBI. But that part, it was basically half of downtown, the southwestern half of downtown, one of the two predominantly black communities in Los Angeles, the other one being CD10, where Herb Wesson is. The real interest here is that Wesson and Perry,
who are
now both running for the same seat, really don't like each other.
Yeah.
And a big part of the reason why is, or at least the culmination of the reason why, is that Herb Wesson used his influence on the city council to redistrict Jan Perry out of a considerable part of downtown in 2011. Mm-hmm. So now CD9 basically is LA Live down south past the 10, but mm-hmm. it does not include nearly as much of downtown as it previously did. All of that has been given over to CD14, which right. is Jose Huizar's district. Mm-hmm. That was something that was done as observers noted at the time, specifically because these two did not get along very well, and it was seen as a way to
land grab.
Yeah, basically. And there's a really amazing quote from 2012 in the LA Times where Jose Huizar says that, you know, of course he wants more of downtown in his district, but he's not in this for the money.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so...
And I will say that Curran Price, who took over at CD9, seems to have made the best of what he got.
Yes.
And still managed to end up in an FBI.
In an active investigation.
Yes.
So that is this kind of the history there. Perry doesn't like Wesson. Wesson, of course, his chief of staff, is also named in the FBI investigation that is ongoing. So Wesson is going to have to defend himself regardless. I mean, we know that there have been no charges filed in this case. The corruption scandal is still unfolding. We don't know whether or not Deron Williams is directly tied to any wrongdoing mm-hmm. per se at this point. However, having that open investigation is definitely a cloud on Wesson's run. He's running against somebody who has all the incentive in the world to bring it up against him, and so he will have to definitely defend his integrity.
This is gonna be good.
This is gonna be crazy. Let's talk a little bit about Adam Schiff, who I don't think we've ever mentioned on this show. I believe he's the congressman of all of us in this room, representing the 28th.
Not mine.
He's not yours?
Mm-mm.
Who's yours?
Jimmy Gomez.
Oh, that's right. He's representing the 28th district, and he is making little gestures at a run for president in 2020. He went to New Hampshire, and I'm interested in exploring a question that something that Scott brought up on Twitter, which was, I remember when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got elected, the first thought that I had, and probably a bunch of other people in LA, is there a way to replicate this here,
yeah.
like they did in New York City? And I remember thinking of Adam Schiff too. This is someone who is something of a hawk. Is friendly. He's like on the more corporate side of the Democrats. And you were saying that he was someone who would be ripe for a campaign against him from the left, a primary mm-hmm. challenge, basically. Alyssa, do you have an opinion on this? Because I don't necessarily agree with that, but I want to hear.
You think he could get taken out by someone on the left?
Yeah, and I'll explain why in a second.
Well, I think he's if you aren't familiar with him, and you might not be. I don't know do people know who he is? Who's not?
I think
from?
So. Okay. I think he's pretty famous
because
really
he's been
famous.
Because he's become the person who's like out there speaking about. He's on the Intelligence Committee, and he's mm-hmm. like talking about the Russia stuff. And
he's on TV all the time.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But do people really know like what he is besides that? You know, like people understand like where he's from or anything? So he's come out as like the voice and I think the face of like Trump's Russian dabblings mm-hmm. or whatever, and is always saying these things and posting things on Twitter. But I feel like people might not even know that what he stands for or where he's from, or I feel like unless you're here, you might not know where he stands on the issue. So that was my big question before we got into the conversation is like, does anyone outside of here, I mean, I guess it is up to us to elect him or not, but like, you know, or you guys.
He comes from a proud tradition of Massachusetts immigrants, along with Mike Bonin and his Davenport, who ended up here.
Who now will never leave.
Yes.
So my thought process is basically this. Adam Schiff he's been in Congress for nearly 20 years now. So going back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11, he has risen to prominence, as you were saying, he's like a sort of hawkish. He's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. As we've been talking about, he is very famous nationally now. He's probably one of the, I would say top 10 most famous Democrats nationally because he is, as leftists like to call him, Mr. Russiagate. Mm-hmm. That is
basically
his role.
And Ted Lieu on the West Side have emerged in kind of the same way.
Yes, although Ted Lieu is more just Twitter sniping.
Yeah, he's not on the talk shows. Yeah, and, I mean, now that you're saying it.
Investigating.
That's a good nickname for him. Like,
it's not mine.
Yeah,
I mean, but
now that you're saying it, I mean, I do think people might know. Like, he's been on, like, Colbert, right? He's, like, been on
that is
talk shows.
Yes. Right? Yeah. That is basically what he does. He's on the media circuit with a number of other people whose goal it is to call into question the legitimacy of the Trump election specifically, and using that disparage his presidency. Mm-hmm. That's kind of his role. That's kind of what he does. He is using that, as we were talking about, to go to New Hampshire to sort of test the waters for whether or not he could successfully launch a presidential campaign.
Yep.
I personally think that it's a bit crowded in 2020 for him, but I mean,
I just can't help but compare it to the other presidential campaign we've been talking about in this episode, Garcetti's, and just think that compared to Garcetti, it looks like a layup. Like,
oh yeah, like, no, it's a much better. He's got a way higher profile. He has legislative achievements, make of them what you will. They exist. It does seem like he has a better case than Garcetti, but I also am completely befuddled by the Garcetti run. We have a number of California Democrats in particular running in 2020 already.
Eric Swalwell looks like he might get in there too. Another representative.
Good thing Tom Steyer cleared the field by leaving. My question that I posted on Twitter is, even though he is so famous nationally, is it possible that, much in the way Joe Crowley in Brooklyn and Queens was ousted by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, despite being very high ranking in the party, that means a lot more on a national level, I think, than it does locally? Is Schiff actually in touch with the district locally? Is an interesting question to me. And I think that he could potentially be ripe to be knocked off in a similar primary challenge, because if you look at the 28th district, which I've started doing more lately, you do tend to see this divide between like the Burbank, Glendale, Pasadena, the Foothill and Arroyo cities, and the LA Basin, which his district also contains part of, stretching from West Hollywood over to Echo Park, basically. That's CD13, parts of CD4. Some of the youngest, most progressive parts of the entire city. If you look at the election returns from November, it stands out. Like, LA is a very blue region generally. But that specific sort of trans Hollywood nexus there stands out as the most progressive, the deepest blue on the map. So we kind of wonder, I've had troubling conversations with Schiff's office personally, like immediately after Trump's election, when Dianne Feinstein voted to confirm Mike Pompeo as CIA chief.
Yeah.
And I called, I called Feinstein's office. And they said, oh, well, the senator has it on good authority from Adam Schiff personally that Mike Pompeo is a good person and that he...
That's what they told you?
Yep. And so then I called Schiff's office and said, what the hell is that all about? And
they don't have to tell you that. They just say, well, pass it along.
It was actually in her press release, as
weird.
I recall. Yeah. Well, she was kind of passing the buck, I think.
A good person.
Yeah, man.
So then I called Schiff's office, and his people basically said, well, it doesn't even matter if she votes no anyway.
Right.
And I said, oh, that's not a great answer. I don't know. So I've had my things with Schiff's office. But yeah, he's very moderate, and his district seems like it's very progressive and trending more so.
Right.
Which leads me to kind of believe that if you have a relatively small number of wealthy Democrats in the Arroyo and in the foothills that are much more concerned with symbolic resistance to Trump, that they are probably more of his base than the more activist
part of the Democratic base right now.
Right. The case against for me is I think the way you get in touch with your home district is more on the national stage than by doing town halls and stuff. If you're in their TV, you can access it a lot more easily than you can if you're actually on the ground or whatever. Joe Crowley, while very high ranking and very influential in the House, was not famous.
Right.
Like not even close to as famous as Adam Schiff is. And I also think these things are hard to pull off twice because people are now on higher alert.
Yeah.
Joe Crowley sent a proxy to debate Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
Like he totally just like dismissed the threat and got punished for it. I think the only way to do it would be similar to Ocasio-Cortez, somebody who could appeal to the non-white population in that district, which is very high. Someone who like people would feel like would represent them a little better in Congress.
Yeah.
But it was also easier, I think, because Joe Crowley was tied so strongly to Wall Street. Mm-hmm. To come at him from the left, where Schiff is, yes, close to the military industrial complex, which people are not into in this district. But I think the Russiagate stuff and just how famous he is would like I think he's basically bulletproof compared to almost anyone else in the country.
I mean, I really disagree. I think that this district is very similar to Crowley's district in certain ways, particularly in that it is young and like North Brooklyn and Western Queens. It is the parts of it that are particularly young have seen a lot of gentrification. So I think that it is less important whether or not Adam Schiff is on TV. I don't see him on TV.
I promise you he's there.
No, I know he's there, but I'm just saying for a particular age cohort that is coming to
that is less likely to vote.
Stands on other things.
But he is less prevalent in people's lives except on social media where he just gets savaged routinely. At least
in our pockets of social media, which are not the real world or even an approximation of it. And he's going to get a lot more famous over the next year as the investigations play out.
Right.
In terms of resource allocation, I do not think it's the best use of anyone's time. Let's do an update on congestion pricing. We had the first Metro board meeting where they talked about it after Phil Washington basically portrayed it as an existential crisis. And to everyone's amazement, it sailed through. Everyone on the board, there was like a standing ovation for congestion pricing. Yep. Every county supervisor, every mayor from around the 88 cities, they banded together to get this done. And now cars are banned in the city of Los Angeles.
Truly.
Alyssa, what actually happened?
It should surprise no one, I think, that people on the Metro board continue to wring their hands about possibly things that are true equity challenges for the city and things that need to be addressed and things that just we cannot keep sitting here and debating how like two or three people, imaginary people, aren't going to be able to get to their jobs in a way that's going to like benefit the entire city and world and planet and all that.
Were most focused on Laura Nelson at the Times did a good thread just sort of summarizing what the concerns are from the different people on the board. A lot of people, James Butts, the mayor of Englewood, mentioned the landscapers and workers, people that have to drive, like the trucks into the city for their jobs, and can't take public transportation and maybe can't afford to pay a fine for congestion pricing.
Right.
Janice Hahn, supervisor in the county in the 4th district down in like the Long Beach area, mentioned the landscapers, the pest control people, of course, the emergency blood mobile people, that being something that exists.
Totally.
We all are familiar with the emergency blood mobile. She said it's not a luxury for them to be driving. There's no way that public transportation works for any of them.
Okay, so if we sat and had like a one-on-one conversation with these people. Are they just saying this? I honestly, do they not really think that like those people would be allowed to drive vehicles if it was for their job or for emergencies?
I think it is self-evidently just kill it whatever way you.
So they're just bringing up, because they're doing the, what is it called? Whataboutism or whatever.
There's an option to frame it exactly the way you just did and say, well, obviously certain like people with like could get an exemption from this. The way they do in London, they exempted Uber until like just this past year. The exemptions were way too big in London.
I just have to say, I feel like, so we were very laudatory in our coverage of this last week. I think it's very courageous that Phil Washington brought it up. Now, having seen the reaction to this in the boardroom, where I think only really two, I think Paul Krikorian and Mike Bonin, both out of the city of L.A., were supportive generally of...
I think Sheila Kuhl.
Of Sheila Kuhl,
yes,
also.
That's right.
Is it Kuhl or...
Kuhl.
Kuhl. Yeah, I think those three
name
really...
Is Sheila Kuhl.
She is cool. I was like, marry me, Sheila. You are amazing. Like, she says the right thing. She seems to really get it.
No, those three were somewhat supportive of congestion pricing, were trying to focus the discussion about equity, not on... saying that congestion pricing could never work, but that it was something that would have to be considered in development, which I think anybody understands and agrees who has spent any amount of time.
But what she said, and what I think what other people need to say, and what we're probably going to talk about, is like the most inequitable thing is forcing everybody to buy and operate a vehicle. I mean, that is the thing.
So true.
And they can't
and
see
also
that.
Don't forget the effects of climate change.
Or
that didn't even get brought up. It's not even part of the framing. That's what I can't even believe. Right. I mean, that can believe that, so, but it's all about traffic.
But yeah, so that... Knowing now that this is what the reaction on the board is, now I think that Phil Washington is even more heroic than I did before. I'm actually staggered by that. So I think we need to give
you
a
like
little
to
bit.
Say you stand Phil Washington.
Hey, I've been saying he's been doing a good job for a couple months now, you guys.
A couple months.
Well, no, I brought up that he said. Well, I have just recently been around on this podcast. No, I'm saying on this podcast, but I've seen him asked at these like panels and things that he was on a panel that I moderated and events like, and people point blank ask him these questions, and he says we have to drive less. This is the only way to fix it. You know, he really has been very steadfast and he keeps repeating. He's been very clear about this for months. So
the congestion pricing thing came up originally because Garcetti put out, of course, back to the Olympics. Garcetti put out his 28x28 platform where we're going to deliver 28 of the projects in Measure M by 2028. That involves billions and billions of dollars that are not currently anywhere in Metro's budget. Congestion pricing, Phil Washington and the Metro staff came back with as one potential way that we could help to eliminate that funding shortfall. So this is in order to do something that the board ostensibly wants to do, that they have mostly said that they're on board with. John Fasana on the Metro board on Thursday, for the first time, Lauren Nelson pointed out, he became the first board member to say that maybe it's not a good idea to do this 28x28 thing in any case, if this is what we have to do to fund it.
Right.
But so Phil Washington is trying to advance what the board says are its priorities, kind of pointing out that there is a large gap between, this is something we've talked about on this show before, there's a large gap between the rhetoric around climate change and transit goals and what politicians are actually willing to do.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder, in the past couple weeks and months, we've seen a number of high-level officials depart from Metro. They've lost the chief of communications, chief deputy of planning, and they've lost another one of Phil Washington's top aides to Metrolink. I kind of wonder, like, is this the beginning of the end for Phil Washington also? It seems to me like... there's a lot of top level turnover right now, and for him to be so apparently out of step with what the board wants. I don't think they're going to force him out by any means.
Right.
But nobody else has been forced out either. It seems like a lot of people at Metro are not happy with what's going on with the board.
Garcetti, for his part, even though congestion pricing would make his 28 by 28 initiative much easier to accomplish in terms of public transportation funding, wants no part of it, wants to totally disconnect 28 by 28 from any congestion pricing movement because it would be a political risk for him to get behind it. He said, "I don't yet support any particular proposal or congestion pricing as a philosophy, but if it can work and it can help us achieve our goals, I think it's a conversation worth starting. I'm going to push very strongly to do that."
And he began immediately by not showing up to the board meeting on Thursday.
But when he had it was to go discussed. To his mayor party.
He had to go to his mayor party, and he had to announce that he was going to help out the furloughed workers. Wait, scratch that off the calendar. It's just embarrassing to no, be like
that's,
this.
That's excitement.
I do want to mention just quickly, I saw when we were talking about congestion pricing this week on Twitter, it does get attacked a lot from the left as putting the burden of reducing emissions on the people who can afford it the least. And the way I personally feel about that is you can do all the public transportation expansion in the world. You can add bus lanes. You can do all kinds of stuff. There is no way out of this without making cars less appealing to drive, basically removing the massive subsidies that are currently given to cars. You can't just funnel money into public transportation and hope that it catches up to cars. And because cars are such a like a major part, such an essential part of how we get around the city right now, yes, everyday people are going to make sacrifices and are going to be driving less. But I've talked about it with some other people before. If cars operated by firing bullets out of the gas pipe,
they essentially do,
would you
they kill as many people?
Would you say like, oh, well, you're going to make the bullets more expensive? What about the people that need to like get to work in the cars?
Right.
You know?
I mean, like, it's not. And there were two studies that actually came out in the last like week or two that I feel like framed this so well. And one was from the folks at UCLA talking about we've pumped all this money into our transit system. Why? How do we get more people to ride it? Which is kind of, you know, a very, you could say like with the improvements were made in the right places, whatever. But every single study they do goes back to, well, there are four times as many cars as there were, you know, being added to the city in the 90s. And it just always comes back to the fact that like the cars are ruining the ability of the reliance on cars, and also the fact that people, like you said, aren't motivated to get out of them is ruining the ability to like improve our transit stuff. The other study that was, I think, really kind of grim and frightening looked at the rate of domestic violence on nights that there were bad traffic events on the 5 and 10 freeway. Mm. And in the city of LA, the incidence of domestic violence went up 9% on those nights, on Sig Alert nights or whatever, right? So it's like literally road rage is something that, in addition to all the other public health problems and social cohesion problems and environmental problems, that is not a good way to go through your life, being forced to do it or choose to do it. And if you come home and you're having a bad day, you're going to have a worse day because you were stuck in your car. So if, and what I wanted to also read was something from Michael Manville from UCLA, from who's done many of the studies that I just talked about, not the one, but the one before about looking at Measure M and a lot of other things about how we've added too many cars to our city. In an interview with KCRW, right now, somewhere in Los Angeles County, there's someone on their way to give birth who is being slowed down by someone on their way to buy potato chips. And faced with even a small toll, the person who's out to buy potato chips would probably just figure out a different way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is like the quintessential thing that we're talking about. We're not talking about ruining people's lives who need a vehicle to mow lawns in someone's neighborhood far away from theirs. Although we should probably address that.
Yeah,
in a
that was something
way.
I said. Is it kind of weird? We accept the landscapers as a given. Is it weird that we live in this enormous city and like a platoon of
people drive around and mow,
come into the city every day to mow lawns?
That's a broken system that needs to be addressed. But you see this exact same decision happening. Like, oh, I want to run around the corner and do something. And wow, if there was a better situation or a better solution for you to go get those potato chips, you would do it. Yeah. You would do it.
Including putting a convenience store closer to your house. Something that you would
move
also
the potato chips
fight
closer
if you're
to your
this
home.
Imaginary person.
And probably don't have to order them online either. Maybe that would, I mean, I think like the congestion pricing, the things you want to penalize are things like Uber Eats deliveries and all these other things that make it way too easy for you to sit in your house and have people drive things to you that you could have gone out yourself and gotten.
Yes. The Blue Line is closing quickly. What's going on there?
Basically, the Blue Line, Metro's oldest currently operational rail line, was opened in 1990. And we've been waiting for this to happen now. I guess Saturday was the first day of the closure. They're expected to last at least through September this year. Mm-hmm. Blue Line goes from downtown LA to Long Beach. And the closure is happening in two phases. The first is going to be the southern half from the Green Line to Long Beach. And then the second half, which is supposed to start in late May, I believe, is from the Green Line north to downtown LA, which is, of course, going to also impact Expo Line. As for why they're doing this, we have a number of if you are a Blue Line rider, you chances are know why they're doing this. The Blue Line has become increasingly unreliable in recent years. I know a lot of people who ride it have experienced deteriorations in service, particularly since the Expo Line opened in 2011. So there is an effort underway at Metro to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in replacing some of the rails, including more switches, allowing trains to bypass other broken down trains, mm-hmm. Accidents, if there are any, to redo some of the electrical subsystems that are there. Hopefully all of this work is going to result in a more reliable Blue Line. That is the hope by Metro.
Unfortunate timing, because the Blue Line is about to be featured in probably its like biggest role ever
since Heat.
Since Heat. There's a giant set piece on the Blue Line in Captain Marvel that comes out in March. It's in all the trailers. It's like, and now people will be excited to ride the Blue Line, and they'll show up.
There'll be a lot of international tourists with selfie sticks walking around Vernon Boulevard.
That is the show. Thank you for listening. Listen again next week to LA Podcast.